Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Sunday, February 16th, 2014. This is episode 1058. Enjoy! Hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. And it's time to talk computers and the internet. Cell phones, smartphones. I think smartphones will eliminate the feature phones, unless you want help transitioning. Home theater, digital photography, and all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside of those two nations, you just use Skype. Skype out, and it'll still be free because it's a toll-free number. You can also visit our website, techguylabs.com. I'm the tech guy. These are my labs. You get it? Techguylabs.com, and that's where, when you visit the laboratory, you'll find audio and video of previous shows, answers and questions, and all of that. Plus a link to our great chat room. Always a lot of fun to be in there. Techguylabs.com. You know, last week, You were there, Heather. We had a caller who said something that kind of got me going. In fact, I have to confess, I was a little distracted by his premise, and I don't know how well I answered his question. He said, I don't want to use Google. They're spying on me. And I was a little taken aback. I mean, I understand that people are concerned about privacy. Certainly understand that. And we do know that... That certainly the federal government is spying on us until we, you know, it's okay until you do something wrong and then they got you. And then it's presumed, I hope we all understand that when you use a free service, that they're using your information, the information you give them, to somehow monetize it. Somebody, some wag once said, you know, try to understand what the product is that they're selling online. And if they don't seem to have one, then it's you. And that makes sense. I think if you use Facebook, you understand when you're giving Facebook all that information that what they will then do is sell ads based on it. So, in fact, it's easy to find that out because all you have to do is buy an ad on Facebook. It's all automated. And they say, well, what would you like? Would you like 30 to 35-year-old women living on the Western Seaboard? Would you like people who are interested in horses? It's very granular. And that, of course, they get all that information from the information you give them. Is that spying on you? If it is, then I guess Facebook spies on you. In fact, a lot of sites that give you free services, including Google, if that's spying on you, they spy on you. I don't feel it. That's quite the same thing. I think some of this comes from the idea or the mistaken impression that computers are human, and that if a system like Facebook or Google is designed to gather information about you in order to sell you in aggregate with others to advertisers, that somehow some human is reading your email. Microsoft's very much like you to believe that, by the way. The whole Scroogled campaign. They did an ad called Gmail Man, in which a human being, like a mail carrier, was delivering your Gmail, your Google Mail, and reading it and saying things like, oh, your Aunt Clara says hi. But that's, I think that we're biologically wired to think that's what's going on. But of course, there's no human ever reading your mail. It's scanned by a computer. In fact, and this is where kind of the Microsoft campaign bugs me a little bit, Microsoft's doing the same kind of scanning. They're not doing it for the same reason. Their ad system is not, in fact, targeted, which means you see the strangest ads at Outlook.com that have nothing to do with your interests. I get ads for barbed wire a lot. I don't know why. I'm not actually in the market for it. But what Microsoft does do is they have, and I would say almost any email service, including your own ISP's email service, they have anti-spam filtering, right? Well, how do you think they determine whether an email is spam? They read it. Now, not some human, not some clerk with a green visor and sleeve garters and a little pencil. Let me just read this mail here and see. Oh, look, there's the word Viagra. I'm going to have to call that spam. No, a computer is scanning it and very rapidly, I might add, because there's a lot of email, and determining whether it's spam. Google does that same thing. So the difference between what Microsoft and Google are doing, they're both scanning your mail using computers, looking for keywords. Both of them will reject mail based on keywords that indicate that it's spam or certain characteristics indicate it's spam. The one difference is Google and Facebook and many other companies will then use keywords in your email to generate ads. In other words, the ads you see on your Gmail page, and by the way, they're considerably less obtrusive, at least on my Gmail page, than they are on the Microsoft page. Those ads are what we call targeted. By the way, you can turn that off. You can opt out of targeted ads. But guess what? Google still reads your email just like Microsoft because of the spam. Is that spying on you? Or is it just scanning your email looking for spam? So when somebody says, I will not use Google because they spy on me, I understand that. And certainly that's your right and privilege, and that's one of the beauties of it. It's a difference, a big difference between Google and, say, the federal government. You can opt out of Google. However, I have to say, if you're using anybody's email service and they have anti-spam filtering, they're doing the same thing. They're reading the email. So there, I guess, you know, maybe you shouldn't be using email. Okay, let's check that one off. I guess you shouldn't use Facebook either. And I know whenever you use your smartphone, you read all those, informative messages when you download software on there about what that software is doing. You do read those. If you want to be scared, read them. Facebook just updated its permissions on Android. I don't think anybody read it when they did this, but one of the permissions they added, new permissions. And one of the nice things about Android, Apple doesn't do this, but one of the nice things about Android is Android will show you the permissions that a program is asking for one by one, and even mark new permissions with a big new. So some of us were very surprised about 2 weeks ago when Facebook's Android app asked for new permissions, including reading and writing your text messages. Now, I guess if you're really worried about spying, that'd be pretty scary one. And I bet you that guy who doesn't use Google doesn't use Facebook. The new Android app on Facebook says, read your text messages, download files without notification, read and write to your contacts, add or modify calendar events, and send email to guests without owner's knowledge. These are all the new ones. Read calendar events plus confidential information. And if you were to say they're spying on you, you'd actually have a pretty good case there. This is goes much farther than Google does, but I got to point out, even that isn't really, in my opinion, the kind of spying you're thinking of when you say they're spying on you. They want to add some additional features. So in order to, for instance, here's one feature that Facebook wants to do. If you add a phone number to your account, they want to be able to confirm that phone number automatically by sending a text message to that phone number, which the Facebook app automatically reads and then says, yeah, thumbs up. They want to do that without you having to go through a bunch of steps. That's what they're doing with that. They want to download files without notification so that they can preload newsfeed content. That's what they say anyway. This confidential information thing is interesting. This allows the app to show your calendar availability when you're viewing an event on Facebook. And I guess since some information is considered confidential, they want that too so that you can say, I'm not available. I'm not sure why, but it's confidential, but I'm not available. These all seem like nice and useful features. I think it's good that they reveal these. Android forces them to. Apple does not, by the way. We could presume that they're doing the same thing on an iPhone. Apple says, we'll do it for you. We'll check them for you. Is that spying on you? Is that offering a good feature? I think as long as they tell you what they're doing and you judge it then you decide, do I want this feature? Do I want this app or not? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number, 888-827-5536. I guess the point that I was making is that anything that you use on the internet has that risk. If you send email, it's sent over the internet in a clear fashion. Anything you use over the internet can be, quote, spied upon, and in many cases is scanned by machinery. In some cases, could be spied upon by humans. And you probably shouldn't use the internet if you really want to be private. The people who really want to be private on the internet are using all sorts of very sophisticated techniques. Starts with PGP, pretty good privacy encryption on your email. That means both ends have to understand how to do that. It's one of the things that keeps it from happening. You'd have to use Tor to access the dark web so that your traffic is going over non-traditional channels. And you'd have to encrypt everything so that your ISP doesn't see it. The problem with the encryption is unless you can encrypt end-to-end, which requires an agreement on both sides, at some point it will be unencrypted so that it can travel over the internet and then anybody can see it. Don't... You remember in Breaking Bad, where, well, if you saw the show, Walter White wanted to get off the grid. How did he get off the grid? He moved to a cabin in Alaska that didn't have electricity, didn't have the internet. He had to walk a couple of miles into town on back roads for groceries, couldn't use a credit card. We're on the grid nowadays. Unfortunately, I think we are. I think that's just the way it is. Walter couldn't take it for more than about a year. He had to come back. 8888 Ask Leo. So if you're worried about Google spying on you, I understand. But don't ask for an alternative that doesn't spy on you. They all, quote, spy on you or have the capability of, quote, spying on you. As long as you understand that spying isn't what you think, it's not some guy reading it. It's a machine scanning it. As long as you understand that's what I'm talking about, they all do that. It's happening all the time, and there's nothing you can do about it. And to achieve true privacy on the web is on the internet is so difficult that only experts can achieve it, and even then it's dubious. Get off the internet. Get off the internet. It's the best choice if you don't want anybody spying on you. And but whatever you do, don't carry a cell phone. That's made for spying. Hello, Heather Hammond, phone ranger, taking the calls.
Hey, Leo.
Who do you think I should talk to here?
I have a lovely holdover from yesterday, actually, two of them.
Good.
Joshua didn't make it in, and he's our first call today, Joshua in Nashville.
Darn show's only 3 hours, you know?
Sorry, man.
Joshua, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Joshua. What can I do for you today?
To you, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you, sir.
I have a small YouTube channel that I'm very proud of, but lately my view count has not been increasing, and I was wondering what I could do to get my videos in front of new viewers.
You're stuck at 301, or is it just in general it's not as big as you'd like it to be?
In general, it's not as big as I'd like it to be.
You know that there's a little thing that YouTube does with view counts. It stops if it comes in too fast at 301, and then later.
Right.
But if you're talking like over periods of months, you know, it's 5,000, 2,000, 150. That's frustrating, isn't it?
It is.
You're asking the wrong guy, because I look at our Twitch channels, the channels for this show and others, and it's hard to get it over, you know, a certain few thousand. I think we all have a misconception about what YouTube numbers should look like due to the success of viral videos, which will get, in some cases, the billions of views. Those are unrealistic. Now, there are people, I would refer to a guy named Marcus Brownlee, MKBHD on YouTube. MKBHD on YouTube. He's a wonderful guy. He's a student, young fella. He does reviews on YouTube. He's extremely successful. In fact, just crossed 1 million subscribers. So that sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Of course.
Yeah. And then look at his videos, and almost all of his videos are in the hundreds of thousands, but not all, but some. Some are lower, some are higher, but almost all of them are at least 100,000. In some cases, he'll get 500,000. He's got some with 1.5 million. This guy has got it locked. And this one I would use as an example. What kind of content is your content?
I create gaming videos.
Okay. So you're probably looking at somebody like PewDiePie, who's number one on YouTube, and saying, well, how does PewDiePie do it? PewDiePie, let me see how many subscribers. He has 22 million subscribers on YouTube. Typical video. Now, here's, you know, we'll be over, you know, 1 million. Most videos are 2 million and up. 2 million views. Some are 12, 15 million. Here's one that's 42 million views. Wow. That's what you're looking for. And, you know, all this guy does is just some Swedish guy who plays games and then talks over the game while he's playing them. He makes jokes. He's not, frankly, you know, he's no Robin Williams. So I'm sure somebody like you and certainly somebody like me will look at that and go, well, what am I doing wrong? What am I doing wrong? And I just, like I said, you're asking the wrong guy. If I knew how, I'd do it. I think there's some kind of content that is viral and some that isn't. Now, here's the other thing. I think sometimes we overestimate the value of a YouTube view. YouTube, a lot of kids watch YouTube. And I look at the 11-year-old that I live with. Michael is a big YouTube guy, and he watches PewDiePie. And he'll watch the same video 20, 30, 40 times. Also, YouTube, we don't know how they count these views. I believe that they count it. As soon as you click it, that's a view. So are they viewed to the end? Probably not. The question is, how do you get viral? And I just don't know. I've listened to a lot of experts. It's certainly great if you can make people laugh. That's what PewDiePie does. And I hear Michael chortling all the time as he's watching his videos, sometimes because he uses bad language, and Michael's 11 years old, and hearing a bad word is funny to him. That seems to me not such a success. That's a great idea. I look at good friends who are trying to make a living on YouTube, and sometimes it's hard going. Well, a lot of times they'll include other people. I know iJustine does very well. She's a friend. I watched her climb up from the beginning. People love her video. She's a cute girl. That doesn't hurt. You know, appearance helps. I think in the case of Marcus Brownlee, it's not particularly funny, but he has great content. People watch because his reviews are good. So great content gets you a long part of the way and getting the word out. Now, I've asked people over and over again, if you can make it on YouTube, you know, there's so many videos uploaded all the time. It's such a huge space. Is it sufficient just to be good? And I think the general agreement is it is. Create great content, and in the end, you'll win. But to get jump started, you have to get the word out. And so I think building a community by sharing your videos other places, getting other people with big audiences to visit your channel, that's one of the techniques a lot of people use. What's the name of your channel?
YouTube.com/TheJoshuaPlays.
The Joshua Plays. And going on a national radio show and saying The Joshua Plays, that's a good start. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Boy, I wish I could figure out how to make a viral success on YouTube. It seems to be like catching lightning in a bottle. It's hard to do. It's hard to do. I haven't been able to do it with my network, but you know, I make a decent living, but not through YouTube. I consider YouTube to be a promotional vehicle more than anything else. But that's also because the stuff we do is long. You know, we do long shows. I think short shows do better, right? 8888 Ask Leo, do you know how to make a viral success on YouTube? You're probably not listening to this show. You're busy making videos. That's the other side of it. There was a good New York Times article last week about YouTube stars and how hard they work to make, you know, a decent living, $100,000, $150,000 a year. But that to do that, they have to make videos every day. They have to work constantly to promote themselves. It is hard, hard work. I'm not crazy about the YouTube model. We don't know exactly how much money you make on YouTube. Some YouTube creators have talked about how much they've made. They call it, sometimes they measure it by the cost per thousand. That is, for every thousand plays, how much do you make? And it's a few bucks. It's a few bucks. Although it can vary. I'm looking at a blog by a guy who had a YouTube channel that had 4 million views. He made a total of $5,600. That's a lot of work. I have to look and see. I don't know how much we make, but it's on the order of hundreds of dollars a month. Hundreds of dollars a month. 8888 ask Leo. I have a better way. Thanks to our advertisers, we don't have to worry about YouTube. Aurelia in Riverside, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Aurelia. Oh, I got to push that button. Hi, Aurelia.
Hi. I have a question.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
I hear you great.
Okay. I bought my MacBook Pro in 2007, the end. And I went last month or 2 months before, 2 months ago to Apple Store, and they told me about Maverick.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you, is Maverick compatible to this old laptop?
You're right on the edge of what's compatible. What? Tell me a little bit more about it. Is it the white one, or is it silver? Is it aluminum?
Aluminum.
So it's 2007.
Yes.
Is it? I'm going to look at the specs here on this. So it's not the black one or the white one.
It's not plastic.
It's the silver. It's the silver one. All right. I it should be all right. How much memory RAM is in there? Do you know?
Well, that time I think it's 2 gigs.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They came with 1 gig, I think. I'm looking.
Yeah, and I paid extra to put another.
Put in 2. You can go up to 4. I think 2 is a little light on Mavericks. So you're right. Let me put it this way. You're right on the edge. And the negative of this is that if it doesn't work well, it'll be very slow and painful and unpleasant for you. And it's hard to go back.
Yeah.
So I would say, did they encourage you to do so or no?
Well, they told me, the guy told me... he was skeptical.
Yeah, see, I'm looking at Apple's own recommendations, and they say that you should have a 2008 or later MacBook.
Yeah, because he was asking me when did I buy the laptop. I said, well, the end of 2007.
Like, is it a MacBook? It's a MacBook Pro, right?
Right.
Is it a 15-inch?
Yes.
Okay, so you are right at the edge. They say the 15 or 17-inch MacBook Pro from mid to late 2007 is compatible, but it is very touchy. It says it'll work in 2 gigs of memory.
Mm-hmm.
I'm with the genius. I don't think you should. Let me say this.
I wouldn't.
I think that there's not much you'll gain by doing so. Mavericks, in fact, is fairly buggy. There's some things that will break.
Mm-hmm.
I would just stick with what version of the operating system are you using right now?
Safari.
No.
I use Leopard.
Leopard.
No Leopard.
Yeah, I would try to get a little bit later than that. You might want to go.
You mean the Lion?
Yeah, try Lion.
Okay.
But I don't think you should go any later than that. You've got a 7-year-old laptop.
Mm-hmm.
It's often the case, whether it's Windows or Mac or anything else, that putting an operating system from 7 years later on it is gonna hurt performance. I would put Lion on it just to get there's some features in Lion that you want, like the App Store, and then just leave it at that.
Okay, so in another word, I have to get ready, prepare to buy a new one.
Yeah. Seven. Well, not necessarily. I mean, it will happen that somebody at some point.
Actually, I'm very happy with my laptop.
Yeah.
I love Mac.
Yeah. No, it works fine. And the only time you'd have to get a new one, there are two things that can happen. Apple could say we're not going to support Lion anymore, and you're going to have problems with it. That's what's happening to Windows XP users in a month. Or more likely, in the Apple world anyway, an application will come out that won't run on anything less, say, than Mavericks. And at that point, you have to decide, do I want the application or not? You know, for instance, GarageBand probably wouldn't run on your Snow Leopard 2007.
Well, at that time, it cost me like $2,500.
Yeah, they're a lot less now. You can get a very nice upgrade for about $1,200, and it would be faster.
But they're not 17 inches.
Oh, you have 17?
No, 15, I'm sorry.
15, yeah. No, let me just check. I think if you go to the Apple store and you look at a 15-inch MacBook Pro, uh-huh. $1,299 they start at. That's the 13. Okay, we want 15.
Yeah, I really want that one with the Retina.
Yeah, you want Retina. That's 2000.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Nice to talk to you, Aurelia. Yeah, I concur with the experts at the Apple store. It's just pushing it a little too much. And it's hard to go backwards once you do it. And it'd be better just, I think, go to Lion, because that's going to give you some benefits you don't have, and leave it at that. Karen, Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Leo. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Oh, well, thank you. It's nice to talk to you.
I am calling about a computer that is going to make the last lady's computer look like the newest thing ever.
Uh-oh.
My crazy husband bought a 1986 Wang a few weeks ago on eBay.
Is that it for nostalgia purposes?
Yeah, more or less. And also to see if he could make it work.
So the Wang was a dedicated word processor.
Yes, it was what he cut his teeth on back in the day.
A lot of people that, you know, if you went into a law office or anywhere where they did a lot of word processing, if it was state of the art in the early to mid 80s, it would have been a Wang.
Yes.
In fact, so much so that when they came out with, I want to say Microsoft Word, but it's not Word. The other, Corel's very big word processor. They duplicated the Wang keystrokes to make people feel at home.
Oh, God. Well, it is so clunky. It is amazing.
Well, what did you, WordPerfect, was it. WordPerfect duplicated the Wang keystrokes.
Yeah. Well, we were so excited about it. We were, you know, making all kinds of jokes, really, when you fight.
Yeah, of course. Anything named Wang is going to ask for, hey, hold on a second. We're going to take a break and we'll come back.
Sure.
I'll see if I can help you out here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. You know you've made a successful product, the Wang word processor, when everybody knows the name, the PC software of the era copies your keystrokes so that secretaries will feel comfortable with it, and then somebody 40 years later buys one because it's nostalgic. Karen on the line from L.A., her husband bought an old... Which Wang did he buy on eBay?
It was the 1980s.
Oh, no. We lost her. You hear that? Boom. That means...
locked out.
She bounced away. She bought it in the mid-1980s. You know, one of the things Wang wanted to do was take over the general purpose mini computing space, but their timing was very bad. They reached their peak in the mid 80s, right when IBM released its IBM PC. That was 1981. Of course, Apple had released the Apple II some years earlier, and the Macintosh came out in 84. So it's one of those cases. It's probably a great case study in a technology company at its peak in the mid 80s. But that peak was exactly the end. They had annual revenues in the 80s of $3 billion. They employed 33,000 people in Lowell, Massachusetts. I mean, really, really successful. And if you were to look at that company in 1985, you'd say, wow, that's a great company. But already the seeds of complete, utter destruction have been planted. You know, it's all over. They didn't file for bankruptcy till 1992, but the writing was on the wall when IBM came out with its PC. Except a lot of people, a lot of businesses said, oh, that's a toy. We got Karen back. All right. Sorry about that, Karen.
I'm
not sure what happened there.
I think my nose hung up.
I do that all the time.
Yes.
You must have a prominent proboscis like I do.
I don't think so, but yeah, apparently two prominent positions. And this is high tech stuff I'm talking to.
I love the trip down memory lane. So what is your question?
Well, before I get to the question, I definitely want to mention that Andy, my husband, wrote an Amazon book about this Wang because the double entendre started flying the minute we saw it and started talking about it. So the book is called 69 Things I Do With My Wang.
You know, according to the chat room, Stephen King's wife, when Stephen King was writing with his Wang word processor, loved telling visitors, "Oh, Stephen's upstairs playing with his Wang." And I think I think that you have to be 12 years old to really appreciate that. 69 things. All right. Well, we'll that's awesome. It's a 99-cent Kindle single, so good deal, you know.
The bummer is that I came out, the photos came out to, I think it was 14 megabytes, and we had to get it down to 3 to do the 99-cent book. So the photos suffered quite a bit going from 14 down to 3. But
too much scrunching. What did you use to create this? Did you use Amazon's own service? Or?
You know, he did it, and I believe that's what he used. Yeah.
Create Space, it's called.
Yeah.
So is that him on the cover with his feet on the old computers?
No, it's not. Basically, when you decide to do a book on the cheap, and this, you know, I mean, we wanted to offer it for 99 cents, so we definitely did it on the cheap. You have a bunch of covers that you can choose from, free covers. And when we saw this, I mean, it was like, oh my God, match.
That's perfect.
it really was. I mean,
so does he use it as a word processor? Has he been able to get it running and everything?
Yes. The story is when we got it on eBay, the person who was selling it, and you know, it looked beautiful, and it is, in fact. I mean, it's really nice. It's hardly scratched or anything, but he found it in somebody's garage or something, and he wasn't sure if it was in working condition.
Right.
So we plugged it in, and basically we thought it was dead. Nothing was happening. And then 30 minutes later, my husband presses the button again, and it comes on. It comes to life. and we got it to work. And I think that was when the volley of double entendres started.
Got
the old Wang working.
That's great. So is he going to use it for anything, or is it?
Well, mostly he just wanted to see if he could put a piece of paper in and have it print something. You know, it really is typewriter-ish in so many ways.
Yeah.
And he did, in fact, get that to work. There really isn't much we can do with it.
No.
But we do like to...
It would have been good if he'd written his book on it, but then the problem is, how would he get it to Amazon?
Oh, yeah.
He'd have to print it out and send it to somebody.
It is the limitations. I could go on and on, but we actually, you know, had a good time, you know, putting the paper in and typing something on. And then when we went to use it again a few days later, it was the same thing. You plug it in and it's like it's dead. And then 30 minutes later, voila. And it's been that way every single time.
Huh.
So he.
Yeah, I wonder what that is. Maybe that's how long it takes. I don't know. I've never used one. Maybe it just, they expect the staff to come in the morning, turn on the Wang, and then go have a cup of coffee, chat for a little bit, and then 30 minutes later they can start word processing. I hope that there'll be a Madman episode. I would call Anthony Weiner about your... Oh, no, that's not it. Matthew Weiner. God. I'm sorry, I got his name wrong. I would call Matthew Weiner and say, I've got a Wang, and would you like to use this on Mad Men? And I bet you when they get into that era that they will. That's perfect.
Oh, wow. I hope Mad Men lasts that long. I don't know what year it's up to now. But
they started using them in the 60s. In fact, they probably, you know, they Selectrics. Remember IBM Selectrics? That's actually what I want is an IBM Selectric. I would love to have one of those. We don't have any in our massive computer museum here at the Brick House. We've got all kinds of computers. We don't have a Wang or a Selectric. It'd be fun to have that.
Well,
I don't. So yeah. Here's what a couple of people in the chat room think. That there is a battery in it that is getting a surface charge. And so it's so worn out that it doesn't hold a charge. But it gets a surface charge as you plug it in, gets to a certain point, and then everything can start up. So that's one possibility. Now
that's very interesting.
Yeah. That's a good call. It's possible, that it has to heat up. Now, I know that doesn't sound quite right, but you could try blowing on it with a blow dryer before you turn it on. If that fixes it, then that's what's going on. I'm not sure it's worth spending a lot of time, getting that thing started. Now, I should warn you, if you leave it on for more than 4 hours, you probably should see a doctor. That's terrible, and I'm going to hang up on you right now. I can't believe you said that, Karen. Thank you, Karen. Hey, give my best to Andy. It sounds like a great book. It's on Amazon. Andy Paz, the author. And if I say the name of the book, I'm going to get canceled by the FCC. In fact, this whole call probably should be edited out of the final episode. Thank you. Thank you very much, Karen. Take care. I'm going to take a break. I need to cool off here. I'm going to take a break. We'll come back and answer more of your calls next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers and the internet, smartphones, home theater, all that jazz. At half past the hour, our digital photography guru, Chris Marquardt, will do some photographic myth busting. You don't watch the Olympics, Heather? I'm surprised. Seems like that's something you'd enjoy.
Well, the way we view content these days, it's like, I'll get around to it around to it.
Yeah,
when
that's
someone posts something exciting, I'll click on it,
Well, I thought it was very interesting. GoPro, they make those little portable cameras you see everywhere. They're cool. I have a couple of GoPros. They're really, you can mount them on your head or on a helmet or on your chest. When you get the GoPro, it comes with a bunch of different mounts. I have a head mount that you strap the whole thing on and you put it on your head. And they're tiny, but the quality of the video is so good you see a lot of extreme sports. They use these. The videos of the guys in the squirrel suits flying down the mountain, that's all that.
And surfing.
Yeah. Ugh. And GoPro's marketing strategy is brilliant because, by the way, these are not the only cameras that can do this. But they've really associated themselves with extreme sports. They've made these great videos. And if you visit the website, GoPro.com, they have, the videos just start playing and you see this amazing stuff. In fact, they've even said, we want to be a content company because that's where the money is. Good. Well, the money's in selling GoPros, but they have a GoPro channel on YouTube and stuff. They announced just a couple of weeks ago that they're going to go public. That's the big cash out, right? You go initial public offering on Wall Street. You sell stock. You make millions, billions sometimes. And I realized the reason they timed it is because of the Winter Olympics. So many of the athletes during the Winter Olympics will be wearing GoPros. There was one that just went up of one of our American losers who took a GoPro with him down the luge chute in Sochi. And it is just crazy. Matt Mortensen is a double loser. And so this is, I don't know if this was a medal run or if this was just a warm-up. But boy, it is amazing. They go as fast as around 100 miles an hour. And this is the 2014 Olympic luge run. And you couldn't do this without this little tiny camera. It's mounted on his helmet. And it really is what he's seeing as he's going down the luge. And you get a sense of how fast he's going because there are people... there are no spectators. It's just a giant tunnel. But there are people standing along the sidelines, I guess, he gets stuck or something. And you could see them whiz by. I mean, just like that. Brilliant. Now, of course, when GoPro has their public offering right after the Winter Olympics, they're going to be the hot item. Everybody's going to know about them. Brilliant.
I mean, the camera just seems to sell itself.
It does.
If you participate in almost anything and you see one of those videos, you're like, I got to have it.
I got to wear one.
Yeah.
We're going zip lining.
Oh, perfect.
And when you go there, they actually, you can bring a GoPro, but they have GoPros and they'll lend you a GoPro and they put it on your helmet. And
oh, cool.
Then they sell that to the, you, they take the GoPro back and they sell the video to you at the end of the run.
At least you have a recording of your own self screaming.
Yeah. Zip lining, you don't go 100 miles an hour, but it's enough. It's enough. It's plenty. Believe me. Plenty. I'll wear one. Tomorrow I'm going horseback riding. I mentioned this to you in the break. I didn't really want to, so I said, well, I'm too heavy for a horse. They went, and no, they said, no, we got old Joe. So I'll wear the GoPro on old Joe. It's not exactly going to be a high-speed video.
Maybe.
Clump. 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 Oh, my. Look at that Clydesdale takeoff. Clump, clump. Clump, clump. 8888, ask Leo. That's the phone number. Russ is in Redondo Beach. Our next call. Hi, Russ. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Leo, good afternoon. How are things?
They're great. How are you?
I'm good. At work, I use a XP machine, and its end of life is coming, and which is not a problem, but the problem is I keep all my contacts on an old handspring program.
What?
Yes.
You had a visor?
Yes, I still have it. Actually, I don't use it, but I have it. And I use it just to transfer stuff from two old computers I've got. But I need to update it to something. And I've been looking, and I haven't found anything to transfer to that does a similar
thing. Does the so you have handspring software on your computer?
Yes.
Do you, I know with the Palm, which is the same operating system, you would be able to, export the data from the software to some sort of, format, right?
Right. Now I'm trying to find a format that'll work on, say, Windows 7 and maybe a Samsung G3 smartphone.
Yeah. So the first thing I would do is I would export the data to, probably one of the formats available will be comma separated value or CSV. That's a very common format for this kind of stuff. There may be other formats as well. And what I would do is, do you have an account, a Gmail account or a Google account of any kind?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I would upload it to Google. The Google Contacts and Google Calendar will import those CSV files directly.
Okay.
And then you'll have an online Google Calendar, which you could then sync to a desktop. If you're using Outlook, for instance, there's a sync tool. And if you're using an Android phone, that's trivial. You just log on. You'll do that anyway when you log on to your Android phone. When you first use it, it asks you, what's your Google account? And you log into that, and it immediately populates your data from your contacts, your calendar, automatically. So it's a great way to move from a visor wow, to a more modern PDA. It's just contacts in the calendar, right?
Well, not even the calendar too much. It's just I've got like 1,600 contacts, and I just
You don't want to re-enter them.
No.
You know, I remember the old days when you'd get a new phone and you'd sit there for hours entering your contacts in. It was such a pain. Nowadays, with a smartphone, I haven't done it in years because I keep everything on Google. That's the easiest way. There are other ways to do it, but I feel like Google's free. It's there. It's easy, and it will automatically sync with any Android device, and it's pretty easy to get onto a computer as well.
Okay.
So that's my suggestion for anybody with any old format. That's a really old format. The handspring visor. That was a Palm device, kind of like the Palm Pilot, that was very popular. You can get one for $50 online if you want. We have one, actually, in our museum over here. They used to take these handspring modules that you'd plug into the back. Wow, you could still get them on Amazon. A lot of people still using these. If you have a Pilot, if you have a handspring, almost any old device, if you can export out. So the key is to have the desktop software, and in the desktop software, export it into a format that can be read. One of the most common formats is CSV. That's pretty straightforward. Russ in Redondo. Oh, that was Russ. Jason in Los Banos, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Leo. I have a 2008 compact PC.
Yep.
with Windows Vista.
Yes, sir.
With no recovery disk.
Uh-oh.
And I got a blue screen.
Uh-oh.
I'm wondering if there is any website on Google that can tell me how to...
You may be able to call HP and say, I have this model Compaq. Can you send me the recovery disks? And for a fee, usually a nominal fee, like $20, they will send you a recovery disk that works with that particular machine.
Okay.
If not, then the other alternative is to go to Newegg.com. And since you have Vista, Windows 7 would be an excellent choice. Pick up a Windows 7 install disk. And they're pretty cheap right now on Newegg. You could buy the OEM version if you wish.
Okay.
I think under $100, and that okay. It baffles me that a company would sell a computer without a recovery disk for this very reason. But they did. They do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back in the saddle again. 8888. Ask Leo. That's the number. I don't know how we got, I guess because of the call last hour about the Wang word processor. We were talking about vintage word processors that we have used. And I was a big fan of AmiPro. Loved that, the Lotus word processor. Mary and Michaela are here, like me. They go back a ways in the computer industry. Q&A Write, that was the one I used. I loved Q&A Write for a long time. That was a DOS word processor. WordPerfect was pretty good on the Mac until version 4, and then they messed that up. Then Microsoft just dominated with Word, and everything went away. Everything disappeared. It was Microsoft Word or nothing. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, you want to take a trip back through memory lane, we could do that too. Armin's on the line from Los Angeles. Hi, Armin. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, Leo, I got a question about backing up my files. I do photography, and I got four different hard drives. I got three terabyte ones. And
yeah.
One.
Yeah.
I just upgraded to an SSD, which is filled up already, and I constantly am afraid of losing data. Like, if one of my hard drives gives up, I'm just afraid of losing
data. It's a huge issue because, of course, it's a huge issue for everybody, but photographer in particular... if, for instance, you did a wedding, you're not going to restage that wedding just so you can get those pictures back. That's it. You don't get a second chance. And the last thing you'd want is a bridezilla going after you saying, where's my wedding picture? You lost them. How could you? My friend Peter Krogh is also a photographer, great photographer, is an expert on exactly this. It's called workflow, right? The idea of it's, I mean, workflow is more than just backup, but the whole idea of workflow is a process, maybe a little bit of a rigid process that you go through from the point where you take the picture, you process the picture, you archive the picture, that guarantees no data loss, and that you can find the pictures. You didn't even mention that. Yeah, those hard drives could fail, but also you've got multiple hard drives. You've got probably hundreds of thousands of images. Where is it? So there are a couple of suggestions I have. Peter wrote the DAM book, D-A-M book, Digital Asset Management. It's called the Digital Asset Management Book for Photographers. It's about exactly this, how to keep track of stuff. And he's just released, we had him on, a new one called Organizing Your Photographs with Lightroom. Do you use Lightroom?
Yeah, of course. It's the best software ever.
Yeah. Well, it can be used to solve this problem in terms of archiving the files in a way that you know where they are. And he just released this. If you go to thedambook.com, thedambook.com, you can find both books. My suggestion, Peter came up with the thing that I talk about all the time, the 3-2-1 backup strategy. And he's written about this on a website that he created with the Library of Congress, actually, because it's in their interest that stuff gets saved. It's dpbestflow, in other words, bestworkflow.org. And if you go to the backup section here under best practices, you'll see an article on 3-2-1 backup by Peter. And this is all about how to do the best, most, backup in such a way that you really preserve your data You don't have to worry about it. The 3-2-1 rule he talks about is, I think, kind of the critical thing you need to understand. Three copies of any important file, a primary and two backups. You delete one, you don't do it until you make another one. You need three copies, okay? Two different kinds of media, and this answers that question you had about losing data because of a hard drive failure. For instance, a hard drive and an optical drive or a USB key. And then the most important one is one copy should be stored off-site. That is somewhere else, so that if there's a fire, it's you still have a copy somewhere. So three copies. And then if you use Lightroom, you can use Lightroom to keep track of which hard drive that file is on. And he has a very, very good description of how to do that. So I'm going to refer you to the expert, Peter Krogh, K-R-O-G-H, because he's a pro photographer. He has exactly the issues that you've talked about, Armin. Lots of images. I've never seen somebody take more pictures than Peter. Some photographers, are very spare, and they take just the right image. He blankets anything. Thousands of images a day. So this guy knows how to do it.
May I ask one more question, though?
Sure.
About the Drobo, for example. Because I think I got it pretty much down, the workflow, but I'm definitely going to check out his website, dpbestflow.org.
Yep.
But I was thinking about the Drobo, and there's so many different alternatives.
All a Drobo is, really, is what appears to be a very large hard drive with some data redundancy. So there are multiple drives in the Drobo enclosure, and they use a proprietary technology that's very much like RAID 5. That means that if any one of the four drives, there's actually a Drobo with eight drives, if any one of them, in the case of the eight drives, any two of them fails, you could pop in a new drive and it will rebuild. You won't lose any data. But that's one company that makes these. There are many. Synology is another one. S-Y-N-O-L-O-G-Y makes excellent drive arrays designed to be on the network. The Drobo's designed to be generally, they have two kinds of Drobo's, but the one most people use is directly connected to the computer. There is a network version, but it's not great. I would use a Synology or a ReadyNAS, one of the network attached storages. They do very similar things to a Drobo.
So instead of Drobo, the Synology, yeah?
Yeah, I like Synology a lot. That's kind of my favorite. And if you look, you'll see a broad range, two drive arrays, five drive arrays, and more. Drobo's fine. Now, I have nothing against them. I've used Drobo's for years. They're a little loud, but it's got five drives in there. I'm not surprised.
But all of them will do the same thing.
What you're looking for, the key is RAID 5.
RAID 5.
What RAID 5 is it allows you to make, it looks like one big drive, multiple drives, at least three, usually more drives. And it's set up in such a way that if one drive fails, you don't lose any data. You can rebuild it by replacing that drive. And drives tend to fail one at a time. It's rare that you get two drives to fail at the same time.
Yeah, right now I got, like I said, three. So I'm just keep constantly backing up from one to the other, from the other to the next one.
Yeah. So that's part of it. That's part of it is the idea that you've got to, you've got hardware reliability. And then the other part is the organizational tool and, keeping track of it all. Lightroom and a Drobo or Lightroom and a Synology is a very good choice. But what I do is I have duplicate ReadyNASes. Netgear makes these, two of them. And to get the offsite component, because it's such a, I can't use Carbonite because it's so much data. I will have the ReadyNAS run for a while and then bring it to work and swap it with the ReadyNAS that's at work so that I'm never more than a couple of weeks behind.
So you got two ReadyNASes, right?
That's one way to do it. Offsite is a very important part of this because nobody wants to think about it, but if you have a fire or flood, or there's an earthquake, you could lose the backups if they're in the same location as the originals. So you got to get them somewhere else. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You hear the Kodachrome sound, the song. We just have Chris Marquardt on so we could play that song because we love that song. Hi, Chris Marquardt. Our photo guy is here. Chris, it's good to
and
see
I'm
you.
I'm so happy you're playing that song.
I love it. It's your theme now.
I love it too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's from all the way back in my youth. So
did you hear our last caller? Because we were talking about the issue. Of course, Chris is a professional photographer. you know, keeping your photos, storing them, where do you keep them so you don't lose them? How do you keep them? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I have also kind of a system, but that includes like a mirror disk in my main computer. So if one of the two disks goes, then it's still on one disk, so I can keep working.
That's a good idea. I like that.
Then there's a nightly backup that goes onto an external network attached storage, a Synology NAS actually. But that is in the same house, so if a plane crashes down into the house, that is gone too. So I have a nightly offsite backup, and what I use is Amazon Glacier.
Ah, Glacier is an interesting idea, yeah.
It is, and it's one of those ideas where you put, I'm not going to go into much detail, but you can pretty much store things, but it takes a while to get them back, and this is how they can keep the prices low. And
it's very inexpensive mass storage. But it's not really like immediately available. It's as little as a penny a gigabyte per month.
And it's for geeks. And I have like a terabyte up there. But I'm kind of, I can sleep well at night because right. I know that the important stuff is up there.
Right. It's you know, it's the same idea with Carbonite. The idea is that it just does it. You don't have to think about it. You've got it there. And should the worst happen, you're not out of luck.
And I bet Carbonite is much easier to install.
Yeah. It is. But, you know, Glacier is a really interesting idea because Amazon realized that if they optimized for data that isn't frequently accessed and they say for which retrieval times of several hours are acceptable, then we don't have to charge you much, you know, if you don't need it right away. We pay as much as 10 cents a gigabyte for the storage for the podcasts because it needs to be available whenever anybody requests it, you know. So a penny a gigabyte is good.
Yeah, if I need to do a restore, it might take 4 hours.
That's fine.
For most things, it is, yeah.
So what did you want to talk about, Mr. Marquardt?
Well, I have another myth to bust. And the myth is people sometimes say it doesn't make a difference if you zoom in or if you walk in.
Okay, this is a big argument among photographers because you could have a zoom lens where you just turn the ring and whoosh, it zooms you right in. You don't have to move. You can be very lazy. But a lot of photography teachers and so forth say, oh, no, if you want to learn photography, you should go out and get a fixed focus lens. They call them prime lenses, a 50 millimeter, and then you have to move.
Well, we call that sneaker zoom, right?
Sneaker zoom.
Zooming does one thing. I mean, you can do an easy experiment. Zooming does not change your perspective. And here's your experiment. From the same spot, take the same picture at different zoom levels.
Right.
And then compare those. What you pretty much have is the same picture with a different crop. That's all it is. When you zoom, you're not changing the perspective.
That's
getting
interesting.
The same picture, just a smaller piece of it. That's what happens when you zoom. When you use your feet, you will actually change the perspective. And changing the perspective means, well, it does not just mean getting far or close to something. It also means to look at something from a different side, from a different location, go around something that you want to shoot. And I find that photographers tend to give up too fast. They stand somewhere, they zoom, they click, and then they go. If you explore a subject, if you take your time, if you walk around it, then you'll all of a sudden find that the perspective has a lot more influence than just on the subject. It also has a lot of influence on the stuff around it. First example, look at the light. Light hits your subject from a direction. Usually it does that. So if you have a front-lit subject and you walk around it, all of a sudden you have a backlit subject. Now, some subjects don't lend themselves to walking around them, but if you're shooting a plant or something, that is easy to do. The other thing is that the background will change. If you move around your subject, if you change your perspective, the background will change. And sometimes you can have a much nicer background that complements your subject as opposed to maybe overwhelming it or being in the way.
So that's the most important thing to say, which is that it isn't the same. You get a different image if you zoom in on it than if you walk in on it. Different images.
Two simple exercises. Everyone who's listening can do that with their camera. If you have a zoom lens on your camera, it's easy to do. Exercise number one, choose a subject and then shoot it from different distances. Mm-hmm. Zoom in and out so that it stays kind of the same size, but look at it from different distances. And you will see how much different that makes. Even if you just keep the same background. And the second exercise is pick a subject and then explore it from different directions.
Right.
Try it out. And if you do these two things, you will a light bulb will go on, and you will go, wow, didn't know that, and that might make you move more in the future and zoom less.
And it's certainly a good exercise to get used to composing a photo by moving physically, because it just, I don't know, it just seems to be that's the best way to learn how to compose a photo.
It certainly is, and yeah. One of the best lenses to learn composition with is just a plain old simple 50mm 1.8. The nifty 50, we call that.
They say that because that's closest to just kind of what you see without a camera in front of you.
It is. Yeah. And for a crop camera, if you have a DSLR for a crop camera, that is even turns into a very good portrait lens.
Right.
It's very bright, 1.8, f1.8, so you get lots of light in there. And it forces you, a prime lens forces you to use your sneakers instead of the zoom, and that is really gonna make a difference. You will love that.
Chris Marquardt is our photo guy. He joins us each and every week to talk about digital photography. You can find out more at discoverthetopfloor.com. That's his workshops site. He's also got a great new video series, discoverlightroom.com. Now that, you know, there was a battle between Apple's Aperture and Adobe's Lightroom for a long time, but if you're working on a Mac anyway, of course, on Windows, you don't have the Apple program as a choice anyway. But Apple hasn't updated Aperture in 4 years now, and I'm starting to feel like Lightroom is just pulling ahead. It's been updated several times. It's just an amazing program. So if you are serious about your photography, it's what I use, it's what Chris uses, a lot of pros use, and you want to know more about it, discoverlightroom.com. We also have a photo assignment. I took a picture. We're looking for photos that illustrate the word, the concept, the idea, three. And if you just take one of those images and pick one that you like and upload it to Flickr, you got to find the Tech Guy group. You can upload it there. Renee Silverman, our moderator, will welcome you. We'll accept your picture. Make sure you tag it with the word three. And then we'll pick, I guess, soon, right? A couple of weeks, maybe?
Well, it's a couple of weeks from now, yeah.
So you got two more weeks to shoot. And the truth is, it's not a competition. It's just fun. The idea is to give you a chance to take some pictures and have some fun with it and get out there and maybe zoom in a little bit and see. This is a silly picture, but it has the word, it has the letter number three in it. Anyway.
That's an easy one.
Well, it was at See's Candy, and it was the day after Valentine's, and there was only one box left, so I thought that would be kind of fun.
Okay. Well, you took that. Okay.
That's me. So I'm not submitting it. Don't worry. Chris Marquardt, photo guy. By the way, this was with a camera phone. Doesn't have to be a fancy camera. Just anything you take a picture with, upload it to our Flickr group, Tech Guy group. And Chris, we'll talk again next week.
All right.
Thanks, Chris. Take care. Chris Marquardt, discoverlightroom.com. Phone number 8888. Ask Leo if you have a question, a comment, a suggestion. That's what Val did in Valencia. You're next, Val. Leo Laporte, the tech. Oh, you're next after this word from our fine sponsors. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We'll be back right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number if you have a question, a comment, a suggestion. You want to talk high tech like Val in Valencia. Hi, Val.
Hey, how's it going, Leo?
It's going.
Thanks for taking my call.
My
been
pleasure.
Listening to you for years, watching you on tech TV, screensavers. Done a great service for everybody,
Thank
including
you.
Myself.
I'm wearing my tech TV commemorative shirt today.
Oh, excellent. Looks good.
It's an old shirt. Very old.
As long as it still fits.
Mm-hmm. Barely.
So here's my problem, Leo. Mm-hmm. I've got a collection of 6 to 8 external hard drives running Windows OS. And over the years, I've done backups on these for various systems that I've had 4 or 5 computers old. And there's data on there that I would like to compile, put offload onto one large drive, and then deduplicate or dedupe them. So I have the most current version, and then start backing up with this one large hard drive through 3-2-1 system. What can you do to help me?
Yeah, you pretty much described the process. that's the way to do it. There are a number of deduper programs for Windows. I get nervous about deduping, that is eliminating duplicates, because you want to make sure you're not accidentally eliminating something that is unique. But a good Windows file deduper, deduplicator, will do something called a CSC. It will do a scan, not just the name of the file and the date. You know, a cheap one would say, okay, the names are the same, the size is the same, the file date's the same, must be the same file. A better way to do it is to actually scan into the contents, do a checksum or a cyclic redundancy check, a CRC, on the contents. What that means is they create a number, a digit that's based on the contents. And if that doesn't match, then the contents are different and you don't want to deduplicate them. There are a number of good programs that do this. I'm looking at one that uses an MD5 checksum to deduplicate. It's called Windows File Deduper. It's free. A lot of places to do that. So the process is fairly straightforward. If you have a sync toy application, that would make it easier. What you're going to do, I would do, is can you plug both the big drive and an individual in the subset in at the same time? They're both USB.
Yes, I can. And I have been using Windows Sync Toy, thanks to you, for my primary data, which is my active data that I use constantly.
So what you'll do is take that big drive and run Sync Toy on it against one of the small drives, then plug in another small drive, run it again, plug in another small drive, run it again. Sync Toy will prevent most duplications anyway. And then if you wish, you can dedupe it on top of that. Now you've got one set that's got everything that was on those smaller drives.
Great. Good idea.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great way to do it. Consolidate them all. I would keep, if I were you, I mean, drives are cheap. I would keep the old drive just in case. That's a backup. Never throw data away. We have we sublet to a company in the Tech Guy Labs here called PixelCore. They're great, good friends of mine, and they do a video production, that kind of thing. They do a lot of video. And what they do, you can't keep all the video you're editing online. It's too big. What they do is they just buy hard drives by the dozen, back up the work files to the hard drive, and wrap it in bubble wrap and put it on a shelf. If you go in our basement, you'll see a shelf upon shelf with massive hard drives. That's their backups. They got them all sitting there. Works fine. Now we join Jay in Gilroy, California. Hi, Jay. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Greetings from the garlic capital of the world.
I have been to Gilroy many times for the garlic festival. I love it.
Go ahead.
I love it.
Yeah, next time you come down, we'll host you.
Deal.
By the way, you know, I was just listening to what you were saying about the hard drives.
Yeah.
I'm actually a lawyer for a large computer company that makes large storage systems.
Oh.
And, you know, one of the problems of putting hard drives kind of on the shelf after you store data is that when you go to spin them back up, you know, a year or so later, a lot of them don't spin back up.
We call it stiction.
Exactly. So
sometimes you can hit them with a screwdriver and it gets going.
Right.
Yeah, I know. I tell Alex this all the time. You know, there's no guarantee. He says, I don't care. It's the best I can do.
Well, you know, tell him to call me. I'll give him some money.
I appreciate it, Jay. Thank you.
Yeah, so my wife has a 2010 MacBook Air.
Yeah.
And she uses the mail app on the air.
Yeah.
And recently she's been opening up the app, and as soon as she opens it up, you start to hear the swoosh sound that the app makes when sending email, even though she doesn't have any email in her, you know, mailbox to be sent. And it's, you know, it can be, you know, dozens of times that she'll hear the swoosh sound. Last time it happened, I even tried to disconnect her computer from the internet. While it was happening, I turned off the Wi-Fi, and it kept up for another, you know, 15 to 30 seconds afterwards.
That's annoying.
She's actually concerned.
That's annoying.
Hacked, you know.
No, she has it. It's just the swoosh sound, like this. It goes whoosh.
Exactly.
Okay, obviously it's not sending mail out, I would presume, especially since you've disconnected it. Although I would check. You look in the send file folder and you don't see a bunch of new sent items.
Exactly. There's no indication that any mail has actually been sent other than the sound happening.
The other thing to do, of course, is to check in the settings, check the mail sounds. And right there in the general settings, you can have... I would uncheck the box, play sounds for other mail actions, and see if that stops.
Okay.
If it doesn't, you know, then the other thing to do is look in the sounds system preference pane and make sure she hasn't assigned the swoosh from mail to some other event. Finally, I would probably, if you are, I don't think this is malware at all. It does sound like something's gone wrong, however. It's not normal. I would maybe put something called Little Snitch on the computer. Little Snitch is a very interesting program. It's really Mac only. The idea is it watches for outbound network connections. And if it sees it, it warns you. Now, the theory being you wouldn't have an outbound connection that you didn't know about. So if somebody's trying to connect to the internet without your knowledge, then you want to know about that. Little Snitch is very handy for that. You can, once as you use it, you could say, no, no, that's the mail program. That's okay. So I think Little Snitch is a nice way to just check to make sure that something on your system isn't surreptitiously making outbound connections on the internet.
Okay.
But it doesn't – I would suspect that's not it. I think it's somehow something that's gone wrong, obviously. Let me check and see if I can figure out what that is. We're going to take a break anyway. But keep listening on the air, and I'll see if I come up with an answer. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. And it's time to talk computers and the internet and cell phones and home theater and all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside that, use Skype. Val in Valencia, our caller last hour, had a weird question, but it turns out it is not so weird, Val. I've done a little searching, and thanks to our chat room, we found a long 9-page thread in the Apple support communities about exactly this. In fact, somebody even uploaded the sound. So Val's wife, on her Mac, when she launches mail, all of a sudden hears a bunch of swooshes, the sound that mail makes for outbound mail, but it doesn't seem to be attached to anything. Somebody recorded and play and has uploaded this. This is his Mac. Apparently, it goes on for some time. I probably shouldn't play at all. It's quite annoying, I know. Apparently. This is a snow leopard issue. You know, if this happened to me, I would be pretty irate. So I'm going to put a link in the show notes to this support community thread. There is no response from Apple, as often is the case. there's quite a few people reporting this. So I'm guessing it's a bug. Now, it might be a snow leopard excuse me. Might be a snow leopard bug that could be fixed by upgrading. Maybe go to get the latest Mavericks, and that might make it go away. It does seem to be almost always 10.6. OS 10, 10.6. But boy, there's a lot of people with this problem. What a nasty bug. Tripod in our chat room says, actually, this is supposed to be happening. It's just not supposed to make any sounds. Apple automatically sends mails to itself about flaws and faults and bug reports. And when you've turned on the Mac or you've been running it for a while and you open Apple Mail, it actually is sending, invisibly sending emails back to the home office about problems that the Mac has seen. I think that's when you first set up the Mac, you see that checkbox that says, and it's unchecked by default, but I always check it. Send reports back to Apple to help them improve services and so forth. So my suspicion is that might be true, that maybe it's doing that. Somebody in the chat room said Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan are doing a movie called You got mail. So invisibly phoning home, perhaps, but maybe it's just not so invisible. And maybe that would explain why Apple hasn't responded. Try upgrading to a newer version of the operating system. Maybe that'll get rid of all of that. Wow. We will put a link to the thread in the show notes. TechGuyLabs.com. Every show's there. All the questions and answers. We actually break it down a page to each question and answer, including audio and video, so you can watch the episode or in its entirety, or watch that particular question and answer, see a transcription of the answer, or at least notes about the answer, and then add your two cents if it's happening to you and you found a fix and that kind of thing. Somebody said if you uncheck reporting back to Apple, it does not fix it. So that's not it. I don't know. Dan in Montclair, New Jersey. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Leo.
Welcome.
You. Here I am, another photographer. It's just an endless... And another hard drive issue. So it's really a fascinating program today. I have a 2009 MacBook Pro. It was running fine. I installed Maverick, and it took a terrible speed hit. I do use Aperture a lot, and that really took a speed hit.
Oh, dear.
And everything was kind of... unusable, almost, you know. I mean, I got a lot of the spinning beach ball, no matter what, you know. I would go up to the finder and the menu wouldn't drop, and then I...
All I could say is you might try a clean install.
I did it.
And it still didn't fix it.
No. So, and I had it backed up, both using Time Machine, and I had a bootable... I did another bootable backup using Super Duper. But
good.
What I noticed was, just for fun, I booted from the Super Duper backup drive on an external hard drive, which was faster, though, 7,200 RPM, and it runs extremely well.
Is it the upgraded operating system or the previous one?
It's the upgraded, because I did a backup
of
the existing.
How odd.
So it's working well. Actually, I'm working on it today now off the external drive. I went to the Apple store. They did a diagnostic. They said that the computer was fine.
You know, the internal drive must be a little bit flaky.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So even though they did that hard drive, it didn't. However, I've had a similar slowdown also. I have an iMac, and I also upgraded to Mavericks, and it still had a bad slowdown. I realize it's an older computer.
Well, you know, our first call today was somebody with a 2007 MacBook Pro, and I said, don't upgrade. She wanted to know, is it? And the Apple Store had given her kind of an equivocal answer. They weren't crazy about the idea.
You know, right.
And yet I hear from people with older computers who do upgrade and have no problems with Mavericks, so I don't
know. I know. I've heard them on your show talk about that.
Yeah,
but
so I don't know.
Using Aperture, which may need more processor power, or there's a conflict with maybe with Maverick.
The thing is, as far as I can tell, the only difference between the external hard drive and the internal hard drive is the drive itself. In every other way, because you use Super Duper, it's identical. So it tells me that what it is the drive.
So then, that's what I'm thinking.
It's not unusual. In fact, it's probably the single most common source of problems on computers, of slowdowns on computers, because what a computer will do is it'll try to read that drive. Let's say the drive has a flaky sector on some operating software that the computer absolutely has to have to run. It will try several times to read it and may eventually read it. Then it'll go on to the next one. It takes a while to read that. It can, in effect, look like a slow computer, but all it is that the computer has to work lots harder to get the data. So what I would probably do is there's a couple of things. One is, and I don't know if you did this, but wipe that internal drive and do a full, thorough erase.
That's what I did. I did that.
And it didn't fix it?
No, it didn't fix it.
So I think you need a new drive is what I would do.
Right. That's what I think.
It's an inexpensive fix.
Go ahead.
It's an inexpensive fix.
I was looking at, you know, SSD.
Well, that would make a huge difference.
And I think I can even do it myself. You know, I mean, I got some directions on the
iFixit has great instructions. You can find them on YouTube too. And any individual Mac, they're all a little weird. Did you say it was an iMac?
No, I haven't. The iMac also had a slowdown, but not quite as bad as the MacBook Pro.
This is a MacBook. Yeah, and some of them, it was very easy to replace the hard drive. Some not so much.
It seemed like it was doable. Okay. What was the name of that kit? Sometimes you've mentioned a kit that was fairly affordable.
Yeah, I got it from MacSales.com. It's Otherworld Computing.
Right.
Tell them exactly. They also have, they will, when you get the hard drive, they'll, it includes the tools you need to open it, and they have videos on how to open it and replace it. And then I got with, because I put an SSD in, I got with it an external container for the old SSD.
So I was able
to have, you know, two drives. Yeah, I really like them. I think they're very good. MacSales.com.
And
There's the Mercuries. They're very good SSDs. You will see a huge improvement in speed. People, you know, often talk about how much RAM you have or how fast your processor is. It may be the single most important determinant in the speed, a perceived speed of a computer is I/O, the reading and writing of the drive, and an SSD makes a great difference. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Was it Sprint?
Verizon.
Yeah, it was Verizon for me. We were talking about, has this ever happened to you? You get a text message like days later, or you get a repeat days later. I think these things happen. It's happened to me with Sprint a lot, where I'll send a message. I'll have a whole conversation. It's one-sided conversation. And then I'll ask the person, didn't you get any of those? And she'll say, no. And then a day later, her phone goes crazy. 15 messages come in. Verizon's done that to me as well. So, you know, I think that the problem with text messaging, it uses a really pretty antiquated technology, SMS, which isn't data. It's actually writing on the voice portion of the network. And so it's very poorly implemented. It's pretty much old school. I think we're going to see a shift as all the cell phone companies shift to LTE. Everything, including your voice, will be data. And I think things will become much more reliable. I hope so. Anyway, yeah, WD Mark PC in our chat room says he has seen that on Verizon from time to time where messages just get backed up. TikTok said, I got a message 2 weeks later from Sprint once. I think it's because these are CDMA networks, and I suspect that SMS is not as reliable on CDMA as it might be on GSM. Mark Richland, Washington. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Mark.
Whoa. How are you doing?
Well, I'm great. How are you?
You know, I'm great. You know, you're just hilarious. I've been listening to you forever.
Well, thank you. I'm not a comedian. I'm not a trained professional, you understand.
You know, I think others would argue that.
I'm funny looking. Maybe I'll give you that. What can I do for you?
I haven't seen your picture, but...
Oh, in that case, I'm tall, dark, and handsome.
Oh,
good looking,
right.
Young fella, about 28. Svelte.
Oh, I know that's not true, but you know, I have gray hair, and so I earned all of those.
Hey, if there's snow on the roof, there's smoke in the chimney, or there's fire. I don't know. There's a long. I can't remember that. I'm too old. Yeah.
I just bought a Vizio smart TV.
Oh, good.
And I'm trying to buy a relatively inexpensive, I'm not saying cheap, inexpensive sound system.
Yeah.
To go with.
Yeah. Because the TVs have speakers, but they sound like this. They're not very good.
Yeah.
It's
just like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You did a really good comparison.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea.
Yeah, that's not what you want, really, on your high-def television.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So the best thing to do, in my opinion, is, and it's what I've done, is you buy an AV receiver, and it can drive five speakers plus a subwoofer or seven speakers plus a subwoofer. Then you get a center channel, you know, so you're going to have a center channel for the voice, left and right for the stereo sound. You're going to have surround sound speakers just to the left and right of your ears, and then you're going to have a subwoofer. That's 5+1 or 5.1 sound, and it gives you surround. You're watching a ball game. You can hear the guy going, "Get your beers here," from right behind you. All of that stuff.
Right.
That's the best sound. But it's a lot of people. It not only is it the cost, it's also having wires everywhere, and all of that can be a real
right.
pain.
Right.
So a lot of people choose instead a sound bar system.
Yeah, and that's what I've been hearing, and I'm wondering how that would even be. I don't know. It seems like that just wouldn't work.
Well, it uses so these sound bars are thin bars. They're very convenient because they sit below the screen. You know, and so they come from right where you want the sound to come from. They usually have six or more speakers in that. They're small, so I would always get a soundbar plus a subwoofer, so because a small speaker can't reproduce the deep, rich bass sound, but it's good enough for everything else. And then they use computer imaging technology to shape the sound and create a sound stage that actually does sound like it's around you. It's not quite as good as a full surround system, but it's very good. And our friend Scott Wilkinson, who is our home theater expert, says there's a very good system that's $370. It's both the soundbar and a subwoofer. Comes from a company called Pioneer. You've probably heard of them. They make great stereo equipment.
I thought they'd been out of business.
Yeah, I know. You don't hear about them much anymore. They make a soundbar that Scott, who is an audio guru, I mean, Scott's our home theater guy and particularly specializes in audio, says is excellent. It's you got a pencil because it's a long number. We'll also put a link in the show notes.
I am ready to write.
The SB soundbar 23W. Yeah. And CNET agrees it's the best affordable soundbar if you care about sound quality. But they also say it's not going to knock you out. You're not going to go, wow, I'm going to be blown away. I feel like I'm right in the middle of this helicopter. But it does get the job done. And it's certainly better than the built-in sound on the Vizia.
Now, I've been hearing a lot about on the bass. Speaker being wireless, is that something that's
this is wireless yep, so you don't have to. That's nice because a bass, the subwoofer, unlike the mid-range and the high-end, your ear is very good at detecting the sound location for the mid-range and the high-end. That's why, for instance, center channel, it's got to be right over that or under that that screen so that it looks like it's coming out of Jimmy Stewart's mouth. But it doesn't matter where the bass comes from because the ear is not very good at distinguishing the locale of low-frequency notes. So that bass can be placed somewhere convenient. So the soundbar goes right under the TV or over the TV, but the bass, the subwoofer, can go anywhere in the room, and that's why wireless is very convenient.
Oh.
Yeah, and you can also position it to amplify the bass. A lot of people like to put it in a corner, for instance, for that reason.
Right, yeah.
So this is a great choice. It's not going to give you you're not going to feel like you're in the middle of the symphony, but it's very good sound and a lot better than speaker sound. And for $369, there's nothing you can get that's better than that.
And that's a price that could be even less than that, or
it could be discounted. It's pretty new. I would look. Let me just check on Amazon and see what they're charging. Consumer electronics are often discounted significantly, and this is so new that I don't see it. It's not particularly discounted. It's designed by an audio guru named Andrew Jones, which is why I think Scott likes it so much. Amazon has it for $396. Yeah, I wouldn't expect to get it less than that.
$396.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool.
I'll put a link in the show notes just for you so you can find it. There are other choices. Somebody in the chat room said, consider a home theater in a box. That's a nice choice for a lot of people. Can be fairly affordable. That home theater in a box usually includes a Blu-ray player that has the AV receiver built into it. So you get Blu-ray discs, you get the receiver, and then it'll come with the 5.1 speakers, the six speakers. And those can range in price from $400 or $500 to much, much more. But those are pretty good. I think this is the best choice, though, the Andrew Jones Pioneer soundbar. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And in Colorado, we got Jim on the line from Morrison. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Welcome.
Yes, I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome. Good to have you.
Go back to the days of Patrick Norton and you guys.
On Tech TV on the Screensavers.
Yeah. My wife always commented that you guys kind of had geeky shirts on.
Yeah. That's because we are geeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Your wife knew. She could sense a geek a mile away.
Yeah. By the way, I'm a graduate of CU, Colorado University, and my son is a graduate, too.
And that's where my son's going. Great school.
And in the last year of CU, my son told me about this semester at sea.
Yeah, that's cool, isn't it? Did he do it?
Yeah, he did it. And now he's living in Japan.
Oh, no. Okay, I'm not telling Henry about that then.
Yeah,
I don't want my son moving away. I want this. Our big fear is he'd go to Colorado, love it so much, we never see him again.
Yeah,
didn't even think about Japan. Holy cow, that's great though. I'm sure you're very proud. Japan. That's neat.
Yeah, his roommate was Japan, and he went back to visit, and he met a girl there. And
these things happen.
Married,
that's those are the words you don't want to hear. Met a girl there.
Yeah.
Those are the words you don't want to hear. My my son's roommate at Colorado is from London.
Oh.
Yeah. Maybe you'll end up in England. I don't know.
Yeah. Every night, I'm an audio book fan, and I just got through reading Amanda Knox's book.
Oh, yeah. Great.
And I read the Raphael book, and Amanda is just a tremendous reader.
She's an amazing. Oh, does she read it herself?
Yes. Yeah, I can't believe it.
She's an amazing story because, of course, Amanda Knox for years struggled because, actually, Amanda Knox was the one who... is that the one we're talking about? Not Amanda Knox.
Amanda Knox in Italy, the one that got...
I was thinking of another Amanda. I'm sorry. This is the woman who was convicted just recently of murder in Italy. She wrote a book and read it.
Yes.
Wow.
And after you read it, you'll think she's in it.
Oh, I was thinking of a different Amanda. All right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, my question is, my photo stream on my iPhone just stopped working on my Windows 7 machines, both the one at work and the one at home. It's working good on my I.O., between my iPad and my iPhone and my other iPhone. But it just stopped working. The photo stream just stopped working.
Yeah. Huh. So it works in with some devices, but not all of them.
Yeah. Well, it consistently works between the iPhone and the iPad and the other iPhone.
Photo stream is an Apple feature that allows you to automatically copy the photos you take with your iPhone to your other iOS devices. It's a little risky because photos are just copied willy-nilly, and that could always be a cause for concern, privacy issues. But it is very convenient. I'm not sure. Now, you didn't turn it off on these other devices, did you?
No, it just stopped working. And
so the first thing to do, by the way, this is not an unusual problem. Apple has, for some reason, lots of issues with first MobileMe and now iCloud. The first thing I do is go to your iCloud account in a web browser online and make sure photo sharing is turned on, photo stream is turned on. You might, Jeff in the chat room says, you might turn it off and on again in the web interface.
I've done that. Yeah,
and that didn't reinstate it.
No.
You know, normally when you turn it off on a device like your computer directly, like go into iPhoto and turn it off, it will delete all those photos and then turn it on again and restore them. I am not sure if you've tried that, why it's not doing it. I wonder, it's always a great mystery, frankly, when Apple does cloud services. It sometimes works and it sometimes doesn't. I've had pretty good results with PhotoStream. Actually, two good results with PhotoStream. I'm getting my son's pictures off of his iPhone because he signed into my account. I finally said, Henry, you might want to turn that off. I'm not sure Dad should really see everything you're doing in college. It's better to be in blissful ignorance. So you got to be careful. It will share with everybody else who's signed into that account. I'm not sure. I see people in the chat room say the same things happened. It seems like iCloud stuff can be pretty buggy. Another is saying try Dropbox instead, and that's true. Dropbox works quite nicely. There are a few things that iCloud can do that Dropbox can't do, things like having a screensaver on your Apple TV be your photo stream, things like that. I'm not sure. Best we can say is turn it off and on again on all the devices. Maybe turn it off everywhere, then turn it off on the web, and then turn it on one by one, see if that fixes it. Don't know of another fix. Maybe somebody in the chat room will suggest one. I'm sorry. Nice to talk to you, Jim, though. I appreciate it. Anthony in Newmarket, Ontario, Canada. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thanks. I have a question for you. It has to do with Carbonite and Time Machine.
Okay.
And it's very—it's pretty simple. My question is, I'd like to know, is it when I back up with Time Machine and Carbonite under my user as admin, does it back up all other users?
That's a good question.
I knew that was going to be a good one.
My guess would be no.
Oh.
Because in theory, you want each user has its own privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess, although it's only a guess, would be that neither Time Machine nor Carbonite would back up anybody but you.
Okay. So my next question is, how would I enable Time Machine and or Carbonite to back up all users on my Mac?
So, you know, and by the way, they're nicely complementary. Time Machine is local backup and Carbonite is off-site. And I think it's good to have both, for sure. Let me just see. First, Time Machine. If you're logged in as an administrator, Time Machine will back up all users' data.
Okay.
So that means it backs up the entire hard drive. Obviously, you'd have to be logged in as that user to see the data if you restore. But it is, according to Apple, it is backing up all data.
Okay, so through Time Machine, it does back up all data.
And Carbonite, you can go into the Carbonite settings and manually tell it what to back up.
Okay, and is there a specific location of the?
It's in the Carbonite account settings.
Okay,
just tell it. It says which folders you're backing up. If you back up other people's folders, as long as you're an admin and can see them, it should back them up.
Okay, so because I'm new to a Mac, so
I'm told, and I did not know this, Time Machine by default will back up all users. Okay. Carbonite will not by default, but you can set it to do so.
Okay, but which folders do I select in the Mac? Where am I looking in the Mac hard drive?
Yeah, so. The Macintosh, depending on which version of the OS you're using.
The latest one, Mavericks.
You're in Mavericks, okay. So if you go into your hard drive, you'll see a users folder.
Okay.
And in the subfolder, some folders of the users folder will be all the users.
Oh, perfect.
So you can specify exactly which ones you want to have backed up.
Well, thank you very much, Leo. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Have a good day.
All right, you too. 8888, Ask Leo. You see, there's always something you can learn. You can always learn something new. We're going to take a break. We have one more segment before the end of the day. I'll get as many calls as I can in the next few minutes. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You stay right here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. It's not my fault. That's all I could say. Let's move on to Dean in Silverthorne, Colorado. Hi, Dean. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
How you doing, Leo? Love the show.
Oh, thank you, Dean.
Highlight of my Sunday.
All right. Well, that's nice. Nice to meet you.
Yes. I have a question. My daughter is graduating from college this May, and she would like a DSLR with Wi-Fi. And I'm looking at bundled ones, and what I'm seeing for the best pricing so far is on Costco, and I'm kind of trying to figure out what's better, a Nikon D3200 or a Nikon D5200?
Oh, they're both excellent. They're both excellent. I'm not sure what the price is not the same, I would imagine.
No, one's $679 on sale and one's $999 on sale.
Yeah.
Well, the 5200 is more expensive probably because it's 24 megapixels. Both the sensors, I think, are very similar in the 3200 and the 5200. But, you know, the truth is, get whichever one you can afford, because what the big expense is the glass, is the lenses, as you've probably already noticed. Both of these come with with kit lenses, but she's going to want to get more. That's why she's asked for a DSLR. She wants to have interchangeable lenses. I think the 5200 is now replaced with the 5300, which just came out, which is probably why it's the 5200 is a better deal right now. I would say, you know, if you can afford the 5200, I would absolutely get that. That's a great camera.
Yeah, the big difference between the two on Costco's webpage is that the 5200 has a 300 millimeter zoom and the 5200 has a 200.
Yeah, and that's just that's the lens. That's the what they call the kit lens, the lens that comes that comes with it. I would say that also that's not much of a difference. She's, as I said, she's going to end up getting other lenses. And in fact, one thing to look at is getting a body only and then getting a lens, a different lens with it. Those maximum zooms sometimes aren't super, super great quality. I'd get, here's what I would get. If, you know, for me, it's a great graduation present, by the way. You're a great dad. Get her the 52, get her the 5200. And it's a bet. It's basic. I don't think the lens itself is a great lens, so you might try getting the 5200 body and then getting a nice what they call a prime lens, not a zoom. It depends what her interests are. You might even say, "Here, I'm going to get you the body, and then give you a gift certificate so that you can get the lens of your choice." I'm not crazy about that 300 zoom.
Right. Okay.
But the body is great, and the body's really what you're giving her. She's going to end up adding lenses to it.
Right. Well, this will be her first SLR, so she's actually a very good photographer, and this will be next step for her.
It's a great, great gift, I think. If somebody has an inclination toward photography, having a good camera just enables that, and I think the Nikon line is fantastic. These are excellent cameras. Did she propose these?
No, she just proposed a DSLR.
She didn't say any particular
Wi-Fi.
Ah, I get it. That was the critical thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that does kind of limit it. There aren't a lot of these don't yet have Wi-Fi. That's a newer feature.
Yeah, she likes that feature.
I agree. Allows you to kind of control the camera remotely with an iPad or an iPhone or an Android device. You can also copy pictures off of it very easily. I think it is a nice feature.
Yeah.
I think the 5200 the 5300 is more expensive. It's brand new, and it's not much better. And the 30, what was the other one you were mentioning? The 3200?
The 3200, yeah.
Yeah. When that came out, boy, I was recommending that to everybody. And I think the 5200 is just a little bit better. Really good camera.
Now, when it comes to frames per second, what's the...
Nikon's good. Nikon is the camera that people use who want to take a lot of pictures fast. It's the fastest focus capability, which is part of it. It's 5 frames per second, which is probably as fast as anybody needs. Is she a sports photographer? She likes to shoot birds?
Not necessarily, no. She just likes to shoot all kinds of things. When we're everywhere we go, she loves to take pictures.
And you hear the motor wind every time, huh? Gee, 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 gee. Yeah, 5 frames per second is pretty good. I can't imagine needing to be much better.
Has 4 per second, and the 5200 has 30 per second, according to Costco's website.
No, nothing has 30 per second.
That's what I was kind of going there. That's a huge difference.
Yeah, Nikon says it's 5 frames per second, which is about right. Part of the problem is what happens is you'll fill the buffer. They have a buffer, and then it slows down anyway as it starts to write out to the card. So it's only 5 frames per second for the first few seconds.
Yeah,
I think, you know what they're talking, you're reading the video spec.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, 30 frames per second for video. Yeah. This is great. And by the way, video is very good on these as well.
Okay, great.
I think you're a good dad. Where's she graduating from?
Andrews University in Berrien Springs, Michigan.
And what did she major in?
Speech pathology.
Awesome. Is she going to practice that?
Yes, she is. Yeah.
Smart.
She did 1 year in Spain to learn Spanish.
Oh, that's
she
great.
She can... be bilingual, and so she's going to be graduating and then taking her master's.
She'll get a job right away, of course. That's a great skill.
Oh, yeah.
Very good.
Yep.
I'm sure you're proud.
Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Bob. Nice. You're a nice dad. That's a great thing to do.
Thank you.
Yeah, as a...
Steve.
Dean, I'm sorry. I'm looking at Bob as the next one. As a dad myself with a couple of kids in college, I know how expensive that is. And to have a little leftover for a graduation present means you did the good. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Nathan, did you want me to do a Carbonite here? Or
Squarespace.
Squarespace? Okay. And then we will get to Bob. He's in Beaver Dam, Washington. What are all those ports in the back of my TV? He says. What are all those things for? Bob is on the line from Beaver Dam. Hello, Bob. How are you?
Hi, and it's Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, not Washington.
Wisconsin, of course.
I'm about 50 miles northeast of Madison.
All right. And you're probably buried under snow right now.
Yeah, not that much. Not as much as the East Coast has got.
A few feet here or there. What's the difference?
That's about all. I just have to wade through it once in a while. I don't have to worry about shoveling it because I'm in an apartment. They take care of that.
That's nice.
Anyway, the reason I call you is I'm retired. I'm 75 years old. I'm kind of computer illiterate. I got my computer mainly for playing games, surfing the net, and emails, things like that. But I bought one of these TVs, Vizio, with all these ports in the back that I don't understand. It says internet apps. One says Wi-Fi. Another one.
Yeah. So there's only one. There's only a couple of ports that really matter. Do you have a cable box? How are you driving that TV?
I got a cable box.
Okay.
The Ethernet cable goes from the tower. I got a Windows 7. Goes from the tower to the. To the modem.
Yeah, that's your internet access. That's something else. But the TV's driven by the cable box using an HDMI cable.
Oh, yes, I have that.
Yeah, that's
I have satellite dish.
Okay, satellite's fine. That's the highest quality. That's the one you want to use. The other ones are in case you don't have that. Then you also want to connect it to the internet. Now, I'm guessing you have Wi-Fi. If you don't, you can directly connect it via a wire, but Wi-Fi's easiest. And that'll do it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You don't need anything else. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.